Michel Collomb, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The audience received a map because it was not possible to use a traditionally an overhead projector. I see, of course, the natural curiosity is occurring, but may I suggest you to take the map when I will say it's time, because I'm not speaking about that at the beginning. Sorry.
Please speak also before the microphone.
Right. If you allow me, Mr. President, I think it's better not to read the text that is in this book and that you received. That would be, I think, too long and unnecessary. I suggest to take the elements who are present in this text in a shorter and more systematic presentation. Also, in order to meet two problems raised yesterday. One problem was, is it economy or is it ideology? Somebody said, these people sometimes take irrational decisions and strategies. I do not share that view. I believe they are very rational, but their rationality following their interest, which is in contradiction with other interests. So I think the question economy or ideology is important. And the second problem I would like to face, raised yesterday, was, well, PNAC or not PNAC, is it so important to make a fuss about it, or is it just the same as the usual American policy? I think we should try to avoid two possible mistakes about this. One, by saying that if PNAC did not exist and Bush, everything would be fine. There would be no big problems. And the other danger would be to underestimate PNAC and this actual very threat we are facing and the difference between PNAC and other strategies in the U.S. establishment. I think really PNAC is the policy chosen by the U.S. multinationals for specific reasons. And the whole of the U.S. multinationals, as was said yesterday. And it is a very more aggressive policy. It is a scenario to control the whole planet. It is a scenario of what I have called the global war. It should be reminded that Bush said, declaring war against Axis of Evil, that 60 countries were concerned because helping terrorism. And that the chief of the British Army, when engaging the war against Afghanistan, said this war could last 50 years. So we see a scenario of global war, possibly world war, and it is important to understand that this policy was chosen by the U.S. capital because they consider that the situation is very serious, very dramatic from their point of view. PNAC is not a question of madness or extremism. It is, I believe, the application of the basic economic laws of the system, but the extreme application of these laws. I think the law number one is the law of concentration, monopolization of richness and economic power. If you look at the automobile industry, you had hundreds of firms, societies, now you've got 9, soon 6. If you consider the oil industry, one was talking about the 7 majors, now they are 3 or 3.5. If you consider the aircraft industry, you had many, and now you have just Boeing and Airbus. So we are reaching a situation where actually 300 multinationals are producing a quarter of the world production, and it is increasing. So the problem is, how do you get bigger, richer, and more powerful? How? The mechanism is very simple. You find it in every Wall Street Journal or Financial Times. We have seen a wave of merge concentrations. If you want to compete, you have to become bigger and powerful. How do you do that? By restructuring the production and getting, pushing out of job as many people as possible. If you do that, you jump at Wall Street. The problem is then, to whom do you sell? Because if you put the people on the street and if you try to reduce as much as possible the wages, to whom do you sell? And that is the main contradiction of the economy now, that this mechanism brings to an overcapacity. Consider the automobile industry. They have the capacity to produce each year 75 million of cars. How many do they sell? 55 million. So a dramatic overcapacity. Yeah, so many needs in the world, but we have 20 million of cars, we cannot do anything with them. And the problem is, how do they try to get out of this? By what I would call anarchy in the investment. Every of the 9 big automobile firms that I was talking about is saying, I need to build a bigger factory to produce more cars faster with less people. But everyone is doing that. So the overcapacity I was talking about is going to increase, and also the unemployed. So the contradiction is that now the world has come to a point you can produce more and more, never seen in the history, but you cannot sell it. Because by the mechanism of this system, you increase the gap and you increase your own contradictions. I believe that is the main problem. And you get to what is called the overproduction crisis. During the period 80 till 93, the 500 biggest US firms have brought to the street 4 million of jobs. 4 million of jobs by the 500 most important firms. The consequence of this is the gap. In the US, the 1% of the rich people owned 22% 25 years ago, and now about 40%, and it's also increasing. So if you increase the gap, you come to a solution where, indeed, they cannot sell in the US. And this brings us to the second law of this system, the absolute need for them to export the capitals they don't know what to do with, and to give a higher rentability to this capital. So it is necessary to export capitals, and it is possible because when you go to the third world, the ground is for nothing, the labor force is for nothing, the raw materials is for nothing, and there you can get, as was mentioned, fabulous rates of profits. Michael Parenti was reminding that Bush and others are speaking against jealousy. The people in the third world are jealous because we succeeded and they do not. There is just one small thing he forgets, is that if they are rich, it's because they are stealing the whole of the world. And it's Bertolt Brecht who said, you may tell that there are poor people, that's very sad. You may also tell that there are rich people. But what you may not tell at school, at television, and everywhere in the media, also what you may not tell is the link between both. If they are rich, it's because the other are poor, and because we have been plundering the third world since 5 centuries, and it's increasing. So that is the question that cannot be said. And the second economic law of the system brings unavoidably this consequence. You have to take the control of the economy of the third world, keep the destroy any rivals, privatize, deregulate, keep the wages very low, because if you want high profits, you need low wages, whatever you say. Which means you may not have trade unions, which means you need dictatorship. Now, I guess that the defense will tell me, well, what's new about this? This exists since a long time. So what's new with PNAC? That's true, but what has changed is the crisis. The terrible economic crisis of the system inside in the US, the rate of profit going down, the infrastructure going down, all that kind of problems, that has changed. Because before, you could give to some elite in the third world a part of your profit. And so there was a deal, like with Saudi Arabia, for example. That was the old system. But now with the crisis, the effect of the crisis is that you do not leave even a small part of the profit to these elites, to this local bourgeoisie, and you force them to resist to the plundering because they have no choice. So this, the second economic law, brings unavoidably to the military, the political and military pressure, divide and rule, and wars if necessary. So this increases, of course, the gap. You know that 2 centuries ago, the gap between the rich nations and the poor nations was 1 to 3. 25 years ago, it was 1 to 44. And now it's about 1 to 80. And that is increasing also, despite every promises and so on. So, also, not only inside the US, but also at the world level, the question, if you bring all these people jobless and without wages, to whom do you sell? And that is the basic contradiction of the system. This brings us to the third economic law. This means that the world, for them, is a piece of cake. And the question is, who's going to eat the cake? It is not admitted that the people who produce the cake are going to eat it. The only question is, who between the several multinationals and the several rich countries is going to eat the cake. And this means that it is also a basic law of the system that you have now 3 big economic blocks, USA, Europe, and Japan. There is a huge competition between them. And of course, it is also a big discussion. Is there more unity or rivalry between them? I think there is both. There is unity because these blocks agree on one point: we have to eat the cake and not the people who produce it. But then the rivalry comes on the question, but who's going to have the biggest part of the cake? And then we see now that with the crisis, the rivalry between US, Europe and Japan is growing and growing. And this, I believe, is a factor for the PNAC and a factor for the very dangerous situation we are facing. If we consider how it happened in the history, this is the kind of situation before a world war. I don't say it's unavoidable, but it's the kind of situation leading to. And that's precisely why our activity is very important, I think. Remember, why did occur the First World War? Because Great Britain and France had the colonies and Germany not. So Germany says, this is not fair, we are stronger, we had an economic growth in the past years, we want all part of the cake. First World War. What was the cause of the Second World War? Germany had lost. Krupp and the German capital financed Hitler to make another division of the cake. So, the question is, are we now in a similar situation? You need to remind that, I don't know exactly who, but I can find it. It's high ranked in the secret services of the US. The defense will certainly know. This gentleman told, we are now, with the events of 9/11 and so on, this gentleman told, we are engaged in the Fourth World War. Yes, the Fourth. And it was
Well, of course the defense would know. It was James Woolsey.
Exactly. Clinton's, I was not sure.
Clinton's director of the CIA for 1 year because, he put it, he didn't think Clinton, the president, found his briefings very useful or his presence very desirable.
Thank you very much. You proved to be very useful. The problem for the United States is that if they are engaged in targeting so many countries in the world, it's not because they are strong, it's because they are weak. United States is more or less a bankrupt country. If you consider the balance of trade, the difference between what they sell in 1 year and what they buy in 1 year, and that's very important, the deficit is $450 billion a year. It's huge. $450 billion a year. That's a deficit. More or less it's at this level now. That means the country is bankrupt. And it can only solve this problem by maintaining and reinforcing the U.S. hegemony on the world and the plundering of the world at the advantage of the U.S. So this is why, indeed, economy dictates wars and not ideology. If they want to survive as an economic power, they are forced to do that. This became possible after the fall of the USSR because of the changing in the balance of forces that made possible another strategy for the US establishment. You have to remind that the PNAC policy didn't start recently, but as it was said, the PNAC project started in 91 or 92. They were believing that Bush the father would have another mandate, so this was the strategy ready. What is this strategy? It is the application of the three economic laws I have mentioned, but extreme application. First, eliminate any rival. Eliminate the competitors. Europe, Japan, Russia, China. Second, control, and control exclusively the economic key zones, we will have a look what it is, and the strategic raw materials. Control it, not because you need it for yourself. The United States have quite enough of oil. That's not the problem. They want to control it against the others, to blackmail them, to have the control on their economy in the perspective of major economic crisis coming. And this explains what are the targets of this strategy. Now, if you want with me to take your map, we will have a look at what are the targets and why. First, the first one on page 122 with Turkey in the center. We will see the other after. What I want to show with this, do you have it, everybody? If you don't have, you have to remind what you learned at school and try to find where is Uzbekistan and so on. If you look at this map, you see the battle to control the road to oil and gas. This is about the huge reserves of oil and gas, even more important in the future, because oil will decline, gas will take more importance. And you have huge reserves in the Caspian, under the Caspian Sea and in Central Asia, Kazakhstan, and so on. Now the question is, how is this going to the market? Main market, Europe, Western Europe. You have three possible routes. Number one, you see a pipeline through Russia, more precisely through Chechnya. And there you become surprised because if you are well documented, you hear that the United States supported, financed, and armed Bin Laden militias in Chechnya. Why? Because this is the Russian pipeline. and the U.S. multinationals want to control it and to cut the access of Russia to that road. The second road is a little below. From Baku, you go to the Caspian Sea, in French, Mer Noire, and through Georgia, which understands why you need a state coup in Georgia recently, and it's not finished. The third, because also that is too near Russia. So that's the reason why the Americans favor another route through Kurdistan here. It's only a project. It would cost more. It's very long through the mountains, but it's through Turkey, a very democratic, good ally, as everybody knows. So if we go further to the west after transporting oil and gas through the Black Sea, you get the problems in the Balkans. We were told the war against Yugoslavia has nothing to do with oil, it's humanitarian, you know. The question is, you have a project of pipeline to bring this oil and gas, and of course also from the Middle East, to the European markets. If you see the first road, you've got the Constanta, and then the Danube and Belgrade. The Danube is a very big river, very long, it's a strategic way of communication to bring all this to Hamburg and Rotterdam. That's why Germany always wanted to control it, and that is why Washington doesn't want that Berlin is controlling. And there is a rival road that you find here. It's also a project by U.S. multinationals. You find it as a project below, from Burgas in Bulgaria, through Macedonia, the place where the United States put their troops at the beginning of the situation in Yugoslavia, in 91. There were problems in Slovenia, in Croatia, soon in Bosnia. Where did the Americans put their troops? In Macedonia, completely calm, but on the place they want to build a pipeline. And then after Albania, you come to the Mediterranean Sea. It is very important to notice that the Americans in Kosovo have built a huge military basis called Camp Bondsteel. No media talked about it, but that is the key reason of the war and of the installation there. In this military basis, they installed installations for bombers for 99 years. Now, if somebody of the audience or the defense maybe can explain to me why bombers, airplanes are necessary to solve the problems of the populations in Kosovo, I think we are taking as full, of course, and the reason is different. So this is the first part of the problem. You see, everywhere you've got a road to oil and gas, you've got a strategy of the U.S. to install military bases there, to provoke conflicts, divide and rule, and so on, and to have to create, actually I'm saying that Kosovo and Greater Albania, based on the ideology of a racist movement who want to make ethnic cleansing of Kosovo and Albania and other parts of the Balkans, this is the strategy of creating a new Israel in the Balkans as a place for the US to control the Balkans and to divide Europe. But let's go to the other side of the map. And there, from the same Caspian Sea, you find more problems. Upstairs there you find the way to China and Japan, because there is a project to China and Japan have big needs of oil and gas, so there is a big project there. But what is even more interesting now is the way from Caspian Sea to the south. If you look at the map, it's obvious. The normal way is through Iran, shortest and normal. But in Iran, of course, the United States have no hope to control for long term that country. So this is why there is, by Unocal, a Texan firm, a project to build a pipeline through Turkmenistan and Afghanistan. And then you get the explanation why Mrs. Albright, when the Taliban were doing in Afghanistan, what we know they were doing, Mrs. Albright declared this is internal affairs. And they invited in Houston the Taliban. They offered them a lot of money to build this pipeline. And why? Because if they control that, they control the growing economies of India, the south of Asia, and so on. So it's indeed always about oil. And you could derive from this a very simple economic and strategic law. Look at the road to oil and gas, and you will know in advance the places where the Americans want to build their military bases, and therefore they need wars, and therefore they need to divide the people. I think this is a key to understand the next wars. Now, I shall pass on to the second and last part of my speech. The question of the targets. What are the targets of the PNAC and why? I might surprise you, but I suggest that the main target of PNAC is China. Because the Asian continent is the fast-growing continent, and especially China. You have there in China since 20 years rates of growing about 8-9% compared when you've got 2% in the West. You've got every minister on television. How? What have we done? So that's why they want to control Asia also, because China is a huge market. And so I think the main target of the US and the PNAC is China. And it has to be reminded that during the war against Yugoslavia, the embassy of China was bombed, with foolish explanations by Mr. Jamie Shi and so on. It was a warning. And the warning, you can understand it, this is in the book, a quotation by Henry Kissinger, who exposes the US strategy. And I shall quote, if you allow me, this very influent man. Tendencies exist, he says, emanating from China and Japan to create a zone of free exchange within Asia. This is on page 85 below. A new financial crisis of importance in Asia or in the industrial democracies, that was the case in 97, will certainly accelerate the efforts of Asian countries, listen, to get a better hold on their economic and political destinies. A hostile Asian bloc would be incompatible with American national interests. This is interesting to read again. So, if the people of Asian countries get a better hold on their economic and political destinies, it is incompatible with American national interests. Actually, you find the same in the books of Mr. Brzezinski, who is not PNAC, but who explains the continuity in the policy of the US establishment to remain the only superpower. And towards China, there are two ways, two methods. Either they try to corrupt it, to buy it, to liquidate the socialism there. Either, if China does not comply, they will encircle it militarily. And the question of Afghanistan and Uzbekistan and all the other military bases in Asia is to encircle China, and the planned aggression against North Korea, that is the only reason also, suppress an ally of China and continue the encirclement. The second target is, excuse me again for the surprise, Europe. As I mentioned, Europe has two aspects. It is, on one side, they agree with the US to maintain the plunder of the Third World, but on the other side, it is their main economic rival. And as they see that the US is always taking the big part of the cake, they want to build their own army, the Euro army. And I think this is also a key of the last wars. I completely share the view of Michael Parenti when he said they have several targets, at least four or five, And you must not think that one target excludes the other explanation. No, they are all combined. They pursue many targets. And what is important is not to say this one is important, this not. What is important is to understand the links between them. Europe is a target because they want to get rid of NATO, or they want to get a Euro army that they can use in the Middle East, in North of Africa, and also in Central Africa. They don't want to use the US to go there because they know that if the US go there, they take the cake. So they want their own army to get there. So the reaction of the US towards this is very simple. Try to weaken Europe, try to divide it through Great Britain, Turkey, now the Eastern countries, and so on. And the war in Yugoslavia was, of course, to divide Paris and Berlin and to weaken Europe. The third target I don't need to develop very much, I think it was very well exposed, is the Middle East, the Arabic and Muslim world, for the oil, of course. And again, the question of the alliance. Remember Kissinger, he says it is not permitted that influent countries in an area are allied and autonomous to others. It's not allowed. The same in the Middle East. What was the big crime of Saddam? His big crime is that in 90, at a big Arabic meeting, he said, we, and he was speaking to Syria, to Iran, to Saudi Arabia, to go over the differences and the conflicts they had. And he proposed, we must unite the Arabic people of the Gulf to get more independent towards the US. That was the cause of the war, that was the main crime of Saddam. And, of course, when I'm saying they are making war against the Middle East, it's also against Iraq and Iran, maybe. It's also against Europe, because who had contracts with Iraq? It was Total, it was Germany, Russia. And who is the main economic partner of Iran? It's Germany. So the axis of devil, behind the target that is mentioned, there is a target that is not mentioned, and that's, in many cases, Europe. I shall not develop, but it would be necessary to be complete, Latin America and Africa, just one word. Africa, of course, is a big part of the international contest because everybody knows there are their strategic raw materials. Think just about the coltan for telecommunications and so on. So there is a huge competition, a huge rivalry with France, and you can see the hand of Washington and Paris behind the many wars that you get there. I often say, to explain the idea of global war, we often used to say it is always the same war. Because people are sometimes divided if you are not enough informed. The media try to persuade you, the mainstream media try to persuade you that this war is specific, exceptional, it's because of Milosevic, it's because of Saddam, it's because of Kim, it's because of Castro or Kabila, or I don't know. It's always specific. The United States have bombed 25 times the country since Second World War, but it was always specific. I have nearly finished.
May I ask you to come to your conclusions?
Yes. I had nearly finished. So it's always specific. What I'm saying is that war against Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq are always for the same kind of targets, against Russia and China, against Europe, to control the roads to oil, and of course to divide the force of the Arabic and Muslim world that is a big part of the resistance. The same methods are used, divide and rule, the same methods in... it is very interesting to hear that Mr. Gelb from the Foreign and Council Relations recently proposed, let us divide Iraq as we did in Yugoslavia, and it was a big success for us. Everybody believes that the question of Yugoslavia is a drama, but for them it's a big success, and they propose to export that in Iraq and in the next countries they are going to attack also. So I say the same methods, divide and rule, embargo, which is more cruel than a war, and also disinformation, what I'm calling media lies. It is important to notice that Mr. Alastair Campbell, the communication advisor, spin doctor of Mr. Tony Blair, Alastair Campbell, the man who invented the weapons, orchestrated the weapons of massive destruction, is also the man who orchestrated the information, the disinformation about Kosovo. It's the same one. NATO said, we are coming here to stop a genocide. It was a fabrication by Alastair Campbell. And then now discreetly they recognize, no, there was no genocide. But the public opinion doesn't know. If you allow to me, I would like love to speak also about Spinak here in Bush, but maybe that's for later. Let's just conclude about this essential question, Spinak or not Spinak. I will say not Spinak if you consider Spinak as some kind of monster, some kind of thing bizarre, in that the problem would be to come back to a normal US policy. Then I say, no, it's not Spinak. But if you say Spinak is the policy that the US capital has chosen now against the crisis, also to develop its economic machine, because if you cannot sell to the people, then you have to sell to somebody, then you sell to the people who are making the weapons. And this, it is classical also that it is hoped to restart the economy. So in that sense, Spinak, yes. And it was raised yesterday that the military-industrial complex, is it the key of the problem or not? Also there, you've got two kind of mistakes. Exaggerate the importance, do as if the whole cause was the military-industrial complex, and on the other hand, underestimate. Do not see that they are really now a leading force there and that they influence the economy in the direction of war. So, if I can resume what I've tried to expose now, is that the Spinak is the extreme and dangerous consequence of the application of the economic laws, concentration of the economic power, which leads to the gap, plundering the third world, which leads to the gap, and then dividing the cake and using force and war to to take the big part of the cake. So I believe, indeed, in this sense, it is very useful to denounce Spinak, because the project for a new American century is predicting a century, really a century, of terror, of wars, of embargo, and I hope I brought enough elements to expose publicly the causes and the mechanism of this really unprecedented danger for the humanity. I thank you very much for your attention and your care for the people.
Thank you, Michel Collomb. I ask now the prosecution to raise some questions. Please raise your question very briefly.
It's difficult to be very brief because there are so many points which I think are misleading about information about the Spinak in this testimony. So maybe I will leave it to the defense and maybe explain my position in relation to the defense, because people think, and but sometimes I'm on the side of the defense, but I don't regard myself at all. I think the defense has actually studied the Spinak very carefully, unlike some of the witnesses, and I think I agree with their broad analysis. After all, they aren't really on the side of the defense, so I think they are rather on my side, and I think they are actually having a realistic analysis of what the Spinak is all about. I will try to explain this afternoon in the conclusion that I regard the Spinak as a set of religious fanatics, but not of Christian religion, but of a certain religion of human rights, certain view of human rights and of democracy, and that these people are setting the world afire, and this is much worse than anything that the capitalists are doing or that the enlightened interest of the capitalists might do. I mean, for all the talk about the evils of capitalism, I want to remind, and all the talk of the Marxist about overproduction crisis, it's a fact that nowadays in the world there is far more production and consumption, including by poor people, of material goods. Of course, there's been enormous increase in the population of the world, which makes the per capita consumption rather low, but that's because medicine and agriculture have also made incredible progress in the last two centuries. So one should also realize that the workers were far worse off in the trenches of World War I than they were in the factories. The other thing, yeah, but you see, then I'll stop. Okay, and let me just say about the greatest crime of Saddam. You don't give any evidence.
Jean Bricmont. Okay. I recall that the role of the prosecution, of the defense, and of the commission is to raise questions to the speaker.
What's the evidence, for example, that the war in Kosovo was fought because of this alleged pipeline, rather than because the people who were fighting the war, were for the war, were ideologically committed to a certain version of human rights? I mean, the French socialists who read Libération and Le Monde every day and who supported the war had no idea about the very existence of this pipeline, and they were indoctrinated by human rights ideology from beginning to end. I mean, war cannot occur without people supporting it, and people who support it must support it for reasons that they're conscious of. What's the evidence, for example, that there is support for Bin Laden in Chechnya from the United States? What's the evidence?
Jean-Bricot, what is your question?
But that's the question. What is his
evidence? No, you make a speech.
No, what is the evidence? There is no evidence.
I shall bring the evidence.
Please, you have something to answer, Michel Coulon?
Yes, sure. As as we know each other, that I brought many evidences in my books and only quotations from their side. You ask why? Are you sure? Can you prove that the US made the war against Yugoslavia because of the pipelines? Of course, I did not interview. Of course, there are another reason. Yugoslav economy was too leftist and workers had many rights and it was not ready for privatization and open doors for the multinationals. But the question of the pipelines is essential, and if you don't believe me, please believe the General Jackson, who was commanding KFOR in Macedonia. And what did he say at the beginning of the war about the presence of the troops in 1999 in Macedonia? Listen, today it is absolutely necessary to guarantee the stability of Macedonia and its entrance into NATO, but we will remain here certainly a long time to guarantee the security of the energetic corridors that are passing through this country. Energetic corridors. He doesn't speak about peace and bringing together the nationalities. You can see the result now in Kosovo. It's a drama. So I think you have to just to listen to themselves. They explain the reasons why they have done it. And I would like to try to make more clear, because I see you've got a big problems of double personality. Apparently, you would like to be on both sides. When you say the PNAC is a problem of religious fanatic, I disagree completely. Even if they are, I don't care. Even if they are, I tried to explain why the U.S. capital, the U.S. multinationals, need to reinforce their domination on the third world, to eliminate the rivals, Europe, Japan, to control Russia and China. And if you do not agree, we can engage a huge conference and debate about this because I have books and books and books of facts about it, and you know that. The question is, of course, ideology is playing a role. You quoted, and that is a good idea, why most part of the left in Europe, and I guess also in the US, supported the war against Yugoslavia. Because, indeed, economy cannot rule only by itself. If you are a rich multinational and that you are making the strategy I expose to make richer a very, very tiny part of the world population, 0.01%, against the others, with economy you cannot do that. You need ideology. And then you need to bring all what is said at school and the media and so on. And nobody, even those damned Marxists, will negate the role of ideology. That's not the point now. That's the second question. First, you have to know why they do all these wars. And then you have also to solve the question how they make to accept the people to accept this war and to believe that these wars are good. In this, this is the order of the question, I guess. I'm glad that you mentioned the question of Kosovo, because everybody knows that Bush and Blair have lied.
Excuse me, I ask you to be brief on that because it is not the topic of today. I know everything is linked with everything.
You're right.
But we have to be a little more.
Next question, sorry.
Thank you. The defense?
First, I'd like to address this question of double personality. I appreciate Jean's contributions, not as supporting the defense, but in an attempt to, in the spirit of this inquiry, and to focus on the questions of the tribunal, of identifying the characters of PNAC, of is there a blueprint, what is a neoconservative. I think that Jean has performed a valuable role in helping to clarify the terminology that often gets confusing. And my questions have to deal with indeed that terminology. Is it possible that you're confusing PNAC with the Committee for Present Danger? It seems to me that that almost all of your analysis of the role of PNAC is fits the role of the Committee for Present Danger in the 1970s.
The Committee for what, excuse me?
The Committee for Present Danger that incorporated elements of the ruling class, not just board members, but the CEOs, the presidents of major defense companies, finance, capital, and industrial production, all sectors of U.S. capital, that felt that the United States was endangered, its hegemony was endangered, that we needed new strategies. And whereas with PNAC, we do not see that representation on its board. We see ideologues, polemicists, former government operatives, and not the representatives of the direct representatives of the ruling class. And indeed, the own statements of PNAC do not address any of the questions that you address and that are the focus of this tribunal. Is the blueprint of PNAC the blueprint for the Bush administration? Looking at the statements of PNAC, we do not find that. And again, quoting PNAC's statement of principles, the United States should not blindly do business with every nation, no matter its regime. That at any time that it quotes economic policy, quotes it in terms of ideology, not in terms of the interest of the ruling class. One question, are you confusing the two roles of that Committee for Present Danger and PNAC? And I'll follow up with a couple of questions, and perhaps you can answer them all at once. Why would the United States choose Kosovo as a military base? The United States has 192 military bases around the world. We're opening up the new Europe, in countries that are much more stable than Kosovo, and indeed the United States is placing military bases in those countries. Why would it fight a war to establish a military base in an unstable region? The issue of China. Why target China as a role for control when indeed there's a penetration of U.S. capital in China that's growing and indeed is responsible for the trade deficit that you cite? And in the interest of, I'd like you to address that, and in the interest of clarity of who PNAC is, that you offer testimony from Kissinger, for example, about the strategy of the United States in Asia. Kissinger is not a member of PNAC, is not a signatory of PNAC, and it represents an entirely different branch of the ruling class, if you would put it.
May I ask for a short answer? Thank you.
When I am stressing the importance of PNAC, I do not say that you don't have many other think tanks and committees in the U.S. There are many. They have also their importance. Some of them are studied in this book of Geoffrey Goetz and in other writings. So I believe many of them play an important role. The question is, PNAC really presented a coherent strategy for the U.S. for the key question. If you look at all, I know that Kissinger is not PNAC. That's not the problem. All the big strategists in the U.S. are facing the same problem, the decline of the empire. The part of the U.S. in the global world production was 50% after the Second World War, and now 21% or something like that, and it's following the CIA, it will be 10 or 15%, just the same as China, in 10 or 15 years. So they are facing all that same problems. Now, it's a very difficult problem. So that explains that you have different currents in those think tanks and the establishment that are also reflection of the several interests. The multinationals have common interests, and then on some points they are in contradiction, and this is reflected in the think tanks. So when you say the people in the PNAC are ideologists and not direct representative of the multinationals, of course, what is asked to them is to elaborate a strategy and the ideological discourse that is going with. You don't have many representatives of the multinationals directly in the editorial board of the big media. In the Council of Administration, yes, but not in the editorial staff. Nevertheless, the media are reflecting the ideology that is necessary to make acceptable the economy of the strategy and the multinationals. So I believe what you say is reinforcing what I'm saying. And if they are making speeches about morale, of course, it has always been necessary. Read the speeches from Hitler. It was full of moral considerations. We have to support the oppressed nations and so on. Every empire produced such kind of moral justification. About China, you say that the U.S. capital is penetrating China, though so no need for a military strategy. Of course they are penetrating. The big question is, how should I say that in English? The big question is, in the game between China and the U.S., who will take the advantage from the other? Everybody wants to get an advantage, and the question is, at the end of the game, will it be at the advantage of the U.S. multinationals who are controlled in China, they don't do what they want? Or will it be at the advantage of China for its own development? Because, may I remind you, China, it is very easy to make lessons. China should do this and this, and if they don't do that, they are bad. Let me remind you that you brought China in a desperate situation, as poor as Africa, and now they have changed. They have changed the situation. Everybody can eat and have a minimum decent life, and that's precisely a big problem for the U.S. They don't.
I'm sorry. You said you, what you are representing? Americans, Irish Americans. Who's
you? I mean your client. Excuse me, your client.
Thank you. May I ask?
It's nothing personal. And then the last question, very briefly. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the defense came back on the question of Kosovo, and I think for once I will agree with them. They are right to stress that there is a link. The war against Yugoslavia, as I said, it's always the same war. It was a preparation of what they have done against Iraq. It was a preparation to the public opinion. Look, we are making humanitarian war. We are protecting the Muslims in Bosnia and in Kosovo. Well, they were protecting Bin Laden also. While now the situation is that the Muslims are chased by the KLA and the US in Kosovo. That is not safe. So you say, why would they install a military basis in such an unstable place as Kosovo? I will answer. Why do they give the maximum of their foreign aid to Israel, really an unstable place? Because when you want to install a military basis, you don't need a quiet situation and solving the problems. On the contrary, you need problems. You need people fighting against each other. So they want to make Kosovo and Israel a client state, and they do the same with Azerbaijan, with Uzbekistan, and they will use the same method all over the world because they need client states, and they need it also to have something to divide Europe and to provoke a war in Europe in the competition. Mr. President, I shall not continue on this question, but
excuse me,
if I may just give some...
I appreciate that, and because I'd like to give some time to my partner.
Yes, in order to make it short, to bring to the court documents about precisely this question, because why is it important? Because there is one big absent in this audience, and it couldn't be else, but it's the people who are suffering the dramatic consequences of all these aggressions. We are talking about strategy, but when you go to Iraq, and I was in Iraq, like many people in the audience, the year before the war, you see the consequence of the embargo, you see the consequence of the war, you think about the people. And when you go to Kosovo and Yugoslavia, also, you see that now, because of the policy of your client, there is ethnic cleansing, 200,000 people out of their home, and hate, they propagate deliberately hate between the people. And I had the occasion in Kosovo, and I will give that to you, to make a film about the sufferings of the people there and also the real reasons for the pipeline and so on about war. You've got documentation about this, and this will allow me to finish on this point, and
Michel. We still have some questions from... Thank you. Ah, wonderful, thank you. Of course, this topic, bringing about the whole economic dimension, is a very important one, and we could have a whole day on this. I'm sorry, because we have to give time also to the other witnesses, and that's why we have to try to discipline ourselves. Jim Lowe.
Well, this may surprise you, but I agree with a lot of what you say, particularly with respect to the kind of global strategy that's being mapped out, although I, like my honorable opponent / friend on the prosecution, have serious questions about specifics of what you've laid out. But as a general notion, I agree that what PNAC sets out, beginning with the Wolfowitz, Libby, Khalil Zad paper in 1992, is essentially a geostrategic strategy to control vital resources, particularly energy resources, in the Eurasian continent so that no possible rival could conceivably emerge against the United States for decades. I agree with that. That's set out very clearly. My question, aside from the ideological aspects, whether there may have been some moral or moralistic impulse behind that, the view that somehow a Pax Americana may be somewhat more benign than any conceivable alternative. My question would be, is the unipolar world that the United States is, or that is being proposed by PNAC and evidently pursued, although in a completely incompetent manner, in my view, by the Bush administration, is a unipolar world conceivably a more secure world for the people than a multipolar world or a world that depends on the United Nations as it presently is constituted and works? And I would refer to a recent poll, a very large one by the Pew Global Attitudes Project, which said that while Europeans wish that Europe would devise a foreign policy that would be more independent of the United States, by a large majority, they believed as well, or they said they believed, that the world would be less secure if it was essentially multipolar or worse.
When you say, those are two very interesting questions, I believe, and here we are really coming to the core of the problem. When you say maybe there is a morale behind the Pax Americana, and maybe they do that not only to control economically, but because they believe they are in danger or they want to bring peace and I don't know what, I don't believe that the U.S. establishment is credible as moral or humanitarian, because it is, we are said, a war against terror. If you consider who financed, armed, and supported the main terrorists since 50 years in history, who brought hundreds of Nazis out of Germany to use them in Latin America, Europe, and so on, who brought to power Pinochet, Mobutu, the Turkish general, all dictators in Latin America, and so on, you can see where are the real terrorists, and I don't accept that they have a morale. The question you ask after is very important. Would a unipolar world not be more secure than this frightening competition between US, Europe, and Japan? My answer is that we have nothing to say about that. We have no choice. The reality will decide. The competition, the economic competition, will happen because you cannot imagine that the European multinationals would say, oh, yes, competition is dangerous. Okay, you may have the leadership. Because if you accept that the other multinationals dominate and control the economy of the world, you are dead. It's not a question of morale, it's a question of survival. You are dead. European multinationals and Japanese multinationals are dead if they accept this unipolar world. So we, and the people of the world, have no power on that. The economic war will happen. That's for sure. The only power we have is to explain the causes of this war and the alternative. But that's another question.
Thank you very much, Michel Collomb.